Does that work? Okay, good morning, everyone. This is a report on phase two of a project that my co-author Bruce Turris and I have carried out for the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. The first phase of the report was delivered at the last council meeting, and the contents of that were largely around providing recommendation on monitoring requirements for the sector fishery. The second phase of the report is really focusing more on some of the issues with these monitoring options that we've recommended and some ideas around cost. My background, I'm with a company called Archipelago Marine Research, and we operate monitoring programs with groundfish fisheries in British Columbia. So the perspective that I'm taking in this report really is focusing on looking at the BC monitoring systems and trying to provide some ideas on how they might fit into a New England context. So my story here really starts with British Columbia. I'll provide a little bit of background on the fishery there and the types of monitoring systems that are in place and information about costing for those. And then I'll switch to this coast and show you some of the summarized information that I worked with for the New England multi-species groundfish fishery, and then look at the monitoring systems that really flow out of the phase one report, and then some ideas on the cost analysis. Copy of this paper is available at the front, and I apologize, the tables that I have in my presentation may not be that legible under this under the screen, so you'll note that I put the page number on the bottom right corner of all the tables. So if you're at that slide, have a look at the page, and you should be able to see it a little bit more clearly. So just to get started, this is just a real snapshot summary of the groundfish fisheries in British Columbia. Collectively, there's about 300 vessels. They fish year-round, a variety of ports, landing around 230 million pounds of fish, valued at about $140 million. By the way, the currency between Canada and the United States is pretty similar right now, so I did go through a process of adjusting numbers. Within the groundfish fishery, there's a relatively large hook and line fishery, which would be sort of analogous to your fixed gear fishery here. We don't have gill net, but there's a variety of different trapping and hooking methods that kind of fit into this. About 250 vessels fish collectively about 12,000 days. There's also an offshore trawl component that's about 50 vessels that fish year-round for about almost 5,000 days. There's a very small inshore trawl component that is largely day fishing for live product for the restaurant market. And then there's also a midwater trawl fishery that has, it's a very high tonnage, low value fish that they go after. So that's kind of the whole fishery in a snapshot. The lower part of the table outlines the monitoring systems that are in place. The first one, baseline data collection, that's similar to what we called option one in the phase one report, which is just basically gathering the basic information elements like logbooks and so on. Dockside monitoring is in place for all of these fisheries. At sea monitoring using observers is in place for the offshore trawl fishery, and electronic monitoring is in place for the other three fisheries. Pretty much 100%, although with the hake fishery, there's one component that's exempt from electronic monitoring. In terms of the monitoring systems, basically all of the monitoring services are contracted to an independent third-party service provider, and the history is a little different out west. As monitoring needs grew in these fisheries, the fisheries agencies really didn't have any existing infrastructure to support the monitoring, so it was all contracted out. The agencies were requesting industry to fund all or a portion of these programs, so there wasn't a mechanism for a lot of that infrastructure to be developed within the agency. So these programs developed as standalone data collection service projects. Usually there's a single service provider for a particular fishery. As I said, industry funds a major portion of these programs. Industry is actively involved in the contractor selection, contractor oversight, designing the program. The service providers work under a variety of frameworks. Firstly, the Fisheries Act. The Canadian General Standards Board has a certification process for dockside monitoring providers. And then also basically just contract law in terms of organizing the service. To emphasize these standalone programs, these are programs that the inputs are the basic sort of information requirements. The outputs are delivery of finished data into agency data systems and also providing services according to the needs of industry. So all of the functions around developing resources, training, hiring, management of staff, all of those functions are completely within the programs. And it's they're useful programs to look at because it's very easy to the costs are easy to understand. It's not a process of trying to figure out what part one agency is doing versus another, sort of in these multiple arrangements. Again, back to the monitoring systems, baseline data collection. We collect harvest logs, which are the same as your vessel trip reports, and we also collect sail slips. There's a hail system in place where vessels hail in and out for all of the fishing trips. And there's a centralized data processing process where all of the information is assimilated into a data system, cross-checked and analyzed if there's reporting that's needed. And then that final data set is delivered to the client. Within dockside monitoring programs, we have 100% validation of all offloads. You can't offload fish unless there's a validator there. And the validator's basic function is to verify weights and sorting of species. They also collect harvest logs at the time of the offload. And then there's also sort of a variety of value-added services that occur depending upon the fishery. One of them in the halibut fishery, all the halibut are marked with product labels. It's just a way of trying to distinguish BC halibut. Biological sampling takes place with certain fisheries. Also fisheries where there's a lot of tagging going on, the validators have a role in collecting tags and organizing that information. And then also as part of this program, all of the information is organized, data entered, and put into that centralized data system I mentioned. With at-sea monitoring, as I already mentioned a little bit, there's 100% at-sea monitoring throughout the fishery, and observers are on the offshore trawl fishery, and we use cameras, electronic monitoring on the hook and line, inshore trawl, and the northern component of the hake fishery. The observer program consists of about 60 observers covering 5,000 days for a fleet of about 50 vessels. Their primary duties are monitoring catch, which includes discards. In our fishery, we have about 60 TAC-managed stocks and about 100 and some odd groundfish species that they're working with. Biological sampling and compliance monitoring, those are also important components of the program. In addition to sort of collecting all that data, there's a fairly involved process of consolidating, analyzing, and reporting the data. Because of the timelines for management, the majority of the data products are processed within 24 hours of the vessel landing. And in order to do that, we use a lot of things like optical character reading on forms and so on to be able to get data forms into electronic format quickly. The electronic monitoring program is covered with a pool of about 200 EM systems that monitor about 13,000 days on a fleet of around 230 vessels. We have about 25 field technicians and about 15 data processors that are kind of the engine behind processing the data. The monitoring objectives with the electronic monitoring program are to audit fisherman-reported catch data. So it's an audit tool, not a primary observing tool. And also issues around compliance monitoring, closed areas, things like that. Electronic monitoring programs have three basic components: supplying equipment. There isn't really a ready source for this, so having the equipment available for the fleet needs, having a infrastructure in place to be able to put the equipment on the boats and to retrieve data once the fishing trips are completed, and then lastly, having a data processing engine for working with all the information that's coming out of the electronic monitoring systems. In this program, because of the slightly longer timelines in processing EM data, all the products are completed within 7 days of a landing event. So fishing trip ends and a week later everything's complete. So I'm just going to take a slight right turn and just provide a little bit of background information about electronic monitoring, because I have a sense that many of you may not have seen much about this. But electronic monitoring is basically just a black box data recording device that sits on a fishing vessel. There's a series of sensors and cameras and a user interface. It's really been designed with the idea of not putting any more money into it than it needs to, so it just has its basic functions of trying to reliably collect and record data. The control box is just a metal box that sits in the wheelhouse somewhere, and there's a user interface that shows you the camera views and basic information about the sensors. So the reason why it's set up this way is that many of these programs require the system to be operating 100% of the time while the vessel's at sea. And if it isn't operating, the boat has to come to port. So we want the fishermen to be able to understand whether or not the system's working, and also to be able to troubleshoot problems with us if they're having a problem at sea. The sensors are really quite simple. There's a little pressure sensor that sits on the hydraulic system. There's an optical sensor on the winch to detect rotation, and then we use a GPS receiver. And the cameras we use these dome cameras that have a gimbaled array inside, so you can aim them in various directions. And they usually sit somewhere on the vessel superstructure, providing appropriate views for what you're interested in. This is one of the Cape Cod longline vessels. The analysis of the data from electronic monitoring is really kind of two parts. One is interpreting the sensor or the image data, and the third is taking that interpreted data and putting it together in terms of some sort of a fishing story. So to give you an idea how the sensor data works, this would be just a time series graph showing you hydraulic pressure and vessel speed, and the characteristic interaction of these different variables kind of paint a real clear signature for particular behavior. So what I'm showing you here is, see if this laser will work. This part here is the vessel transiting out from the port. It's heading at a high speed. It slows down on the fishing grounds. This area here is laying out a bunch of longline strings. And then this whole sequence here is hauling gear, and you see the hydraulic pressure is active then. And then this is the transit back. So if you want to lay that into a spatial plot, this is exact same data set for the two. You have the cruise track. You can see if you look closely, you can see the areas where the line is, where the gear is set, and then the darker kind of vertical lines show the hauling activity. In terms of the imagery, with fixed gear, a couple of videos to show you. This one here is a longline vessel fishing for, I think it's targeting dogfish. You can see the reference marks on the background on the side of the vessel are to enable measurement of fish. We're distinguishing whether the fish are sublegal or legal. It has implications for the quota, how quota is accounted. Usually there's an array of cameras, one giving kind of a closer focus, the other one giving a wider view. But in this type of fishing, catch comes over one at a time, so you have the opportunity to enumerate and identify catch one at a time. This other picture here is some set net fishing in New Zealand, where they're hauling gill net over the stern rail of the vessel. I've shown you the wide view here, where we have kind of a rail-to-rail view, but same idea. The catch is coming over in a serial fashion, where you can identify it, count it, and monitor the disposition. I'm going to just try something a little risky here, if you don't mind. I wanted to show you this, and this doesn't show as well. Take me a second here to just resize all this. Sorry about this. There's a problem that the projector resolution is different than the screen resolution, so whenever you try to do this sort of thing, you end up with different sizes that... The reason why I've taken the trouble to show this is I just wanted to give you a sense of the use of camera imagery on trawl fisheries. To get the same sort of catch census of catch coming over one at a time isn't possible in trawl fishery because you have a large quantity of fish coming up at once. But we use electronic monitoring quite a bit to monitor full retention in trawl fisheries, where you can use cameras to sort of monitor rail to rail and the catch coming on board. So this is a sequence of cameras on an Alaskan trawl vessel. And the idea is this is what's called limited discarding, where basically everything that comes up on board has to actually go into the hold of the vessel, with the exception of halibut. So all the fish come in, halibut are sent across that graduated shoot on the right, and we not only can identify them, but we can also measure them. So when you get into larger vessels and more complicated issues like this, you end up developing quite an array of cameras to try to cover all the sorts of views that you're interested in, including the close-up detailed resolution as well as sort of the wide view. This is a 90-foot vessel. It's sort of 30-foot beam, so it's quite a large vessel. Okay, so sorry about that. I had to switch and turn my monitor off, so it took a little while. So that's kind of what the technology is about. We talk about this idea of audit-based monitoring with electronic monitoring. So instead of using a camera to record imagery of catch and then having somebody go through it completely from one end to the other to come up with an idea of what's caught on a fishing trip, we're very excited about this idea of audit-based monitoring, where basically you rely on the fishermen to be the primary source of the data, and you're using the camera technology as an audit mechanism. So this is sort of schematically how it works. We have a fishing log, we have an accurate understanding of what's offloaded from dockside monitoring, and we use electronic monitoring to try to decide how believable that all is. So a real simple example, this would be a log, a fisherman's log for fish that were caught and released. We would overlay the video elements of that to compare the numbers, and you'd get things that line up really well like this, and you'd have other things like this that don't line up very well at all. And you've developed a scoring system for that, so the level of agreement is scored in some way. And then you, if you look at the whole fishery for the whole year, you get this sort of pattern of how well the log and the EM and the fisherman log line up. And the scoring sort of going from green all the way out to red reflects, you know, your level of comfort. And basically you define performance criteria that you're seeking in your data, and then you develop different rules and so on to try to push people toward the middle to get the sort of information you're after. The dark green there is what would be equivalent of what an observer would record, and moving out as progressive distances of data quality. Okay, so that's sort of the background on all the monitoring in BC, and here's the kind of the punchline in terms of the system costs. You might want to look at page 16 because it sure doesn't show up well there. But just when you look at sort of big numbers, it is a big program. The monitoring program costs over $6.5 million for that fishery. When you work it out in terms of price per pound, total cost is anywhere from less than a penny to about 9 cents a pound. And in terms of the value of the fishery, the cost is anywhere from about 3% to 19%. So the 19% is that inshore fishery that I mentioned earlier, but largely the offshore fisheries are in sort of the 3 to 4% range. The other thing I want you to notice from the slide is that the ATSI Observer Program cost is about $560 a day, and the EM electronic monitoring component cost is about $150 a day. This is the first time that I've really analyzed these numbers, especially the electronic monitoring, where I've incorporated not only the cost of the program, but also the actual cost of the equipment, whether or not it's purchased by somebody or whether it's rented. So that's a really significant difference there. I see is almost a fourfold difference between the technology-based monitoring versus observer monitoring. Okay, moving into the New England groundfish fishery, I'm just presenting here data that were provided to me from Andrew Kitts with the National Marine Fisheries Service. These are 2006 data for the multi-species fishery, in total about 650 vessels, 48 million pounds landed, $73 million overall. And then also sort of summarizing some of the data that I was provided. I was curious to look at landing ports for this fishery. There's one port, Gloucester, that has nearly 35% of the landings. Four ports provide between 5 and 10% of the landings. And then there's a whole host of others that have lesser amounts. So I'm probably not telling you guys anything you don't already know, but it was of interest to me. And then looking at it in terms of a different way, histograms, the port on the far left is Gloucester, and then these are percent of the total landing events for the fishery. So you end up with a real concentration of landing activity in the fishery to a handful of ports, and there's, you know, nearly half the ports that are there have a very, very small contribution in total landings. Looking at it in terms of landed weights, some of the ports are focus points for the larger vessel, large quantity landings, so the distribution's a little bit different. But the story is still the same. You have a handful of ports where the major activity is, and then a large number of ports where there's very, very low levels. This table here just provides a bit of a comparison between the BC and the New England fishery for context. And in terms of, I realize also that the New England data that I have may not be inclusive of the total value or the total quantities because it's simply groundfish. So I'm just working with what I had, but the comparison is interesting anyway. The pounds landed nearly 50 million in New England versus about 230 million for BC. The dollar value for the New England is about half that of the British Columbia fishery. But what's worth noting and really looking at is the number of trips in the BC fishery is about 3,500 versus about 18,000. The number of days at sea, even though BC sea days and New England day at sea, they're not exactly the same, but even considering that they might be, 20,000 days at sea in BC versus 32,000 days at sea in New England. And the other thing that's interesting is the value of catch per trip in the British Columbia is nearly $40,000 on average versus about $3,800 in New England, so sort of an order of magnitude. And I'm pointing these out because I think these kinds of things really drive the monitoring program. With dockside monitoring, each trip that lands is kind of like a packet of data that's processed, so the scaling for cost is numbers of trips. For an at-sea observer program, the number of days at sea is a really useful way of sort of scaling a program. So looking at a New England fishery that lands less fish in more trips and more days at sea becomes problematic, you know, for a monitoring program. The next few slides here just kind of outline some further thoughts on the different monitoring options that we put into the Phase one report, and they really flow out of the recommendations, so there isn't really anything overly new. The idea of service delivery is sort of a standalone third-party service provision. Bruce had recommended a 5-year contract term because of the integrated program. It takes quite a while to get everything kind of tuned and working properly. We recommended a government or some sort of government agency contractor selection process. There needs to be some umbrella group that could do that. And we also recommended industry participation in program funding. And I'll come back to that one. In terms of the monitoring systems, the modified status quo option one, which I call baseline data collection, applies to both sector and common pool fishery. It has to do with gathering the dealer reports, the trip reports, and the hail system, and putting that into a centralized data system that would eventually be connected with the other monitoring components. The dockside monitoring program is really the same as I outlined in the BC, except that in our report we recommended two different sort of coverage level options. We provided for a less than 100% monitoring and 100% monitoring. So there's two different ways of looking at it. I think the big difference between New England and BC in a dockside monitoring program is that most of the validation for offloads would occur at plants or auctions. That very skewed distribution I showed you a few slides back, I think, lends itself really well for that. There's a tremendous efficiencies to be gained in monitoring the larger quantities of fish that are coming through plants and auction houses. And then we introduced the idea of using a roving monitor for the remote ports and basically kind of a partial coverage of the actual point of offload if the offload is going to be going from boat to truck and then to a plant. With the at-sea monitoring, we outlined three different coverage level options. The first one was less than 100% for both an at-sea and an electronic monitoring program. The second option was 100% for electronic monitoring, but less than 100% for at-sea observing. And the third one was 100% monitoring for the two. In our looking at this, our thought was that the at-sea observer program would apply to the multi-area trawl fishery, so larger vessels fishing multiple areas, and the electronic monitoring program would apply to the fixed gear component of the fishery as well as trawl vessels fishing single areas. So the observer element of it, this first point about the observers should be certified by NIMS, I think there was a suggestion or a question that went around as whether or not if there was a sector monitoring program, whether or not there would be some benefits to be gained by having observers of a lower standard than what are currently in place by NIMS. In my view, I don't think there's any benefit to that at all because the role of an observer in catch monitoring I think would be every bit as challenging as the multiple roles that observers have where they're currently used. So I don't think it would be wise necessarily, and I don't think you necessarily save a lot of money to be trying to think of some second-rate observer that you would use in a sector program. So I recommend that they should be certified by NIMS. The monitoring objectives would really focus around catch and discards for the 19 stocks, compliance monitoring, and I put biological sampling in there because my view is that if you have an observer on board and they're trained to do that, there's certainly value in gathering that sort of data. The electronic monitoring program is really aimed at auditing fishing, fishermen reported catch data, as I mentioned already, and compliance monitoring as well. The program components that I outlined for the BC would also apply here. And the only kind of follow-on thought that I had is that because of so much of the fleet that would be subject to electronic monitoring, because so much of that is single-day trips or very short trips, it doesn't make sense to have a process where if it's less than 100% coverage that you would be installing cameras on and off boats for one-day trips. I think it would be more that you would decide on an interval and monitor a vessel for a longer period than just a day. To try to come up with some costing estimates, I needed to make some decisions about how much of the fleet would actually fit under sectors and what component of their activity would go there as well. And I realize these are numbers that, they could be spot on or they could be way off, but you need something to work with. So in talking with Dan at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, we sort of thought that sectors might attract half of the fleet and maybe 80% of the quota. So with that in mind, I took over, looking at instead of 650 vessels, somewhere in the low 300s, and the actual numbers of trips and sea days would be 80% of what the total would be. So we're looking at, for the purpose of the cost model anyway, we're looking at a fleet of around 325 vessels, 15,000 trips, and 28,000 sea days. So this one, you can't read it all on the table, I'm sorry, but what I've done here is I've just laid out some cost ranges for the different options to give you a sense. This is really a process of just having a very careful study of how monitoring programs operate in BC, thinking of some of the considerations that might drive them to be different in New England, and putting in a cost range that hopefully covers that. So, for example, under option one with baseline data collection, I'm looking at, you know, my view is that the cost per landing would be somewhere in the $25 to $45 range. So you scale that up and you come up with a cost of $475 to $855,000 in terms of a rough number of general cost. Dockside monitoring, I looked at the two different options, and for the less than 100% option that we put forward, I just put 50% in, thinking that just to try to get an idea what things might look like. So you end up with a kind of a cost range for dockside monitoring of around $750,000 to just a little over $1 million for the 100% element of that. And then if there's electronic monitoring in place, there are some additional activities that you would need to do in connection with dockside monitoring, so that I've incorporated that in as well. And then with option three, I've laid out the three different options. And if it was less than 100% monitoring, then I called it, I worked with 50% monitoring. So we're looking at those different levels. And for example, with the option 3A, which is 50% monitoring for both the EM and the ATSI observer, it's anywhere from $5 to $6 million. And with 100% monitoring for both, it's about $8 to $10 million. So there's a huge jump from going from option two to option three. The other thing I wanted to mention here is that if you look at the cost per unit range in the ATSI observer element on the bottom part of the table, the National Marine Fisheries uses $1,200 a day as sort of a planning figure for their observer program. And as I mentioned earlier, the BC program is less than $600 a day. So I spent some time looking at this and trying to understand, if you were to take a standalone program the way it's sort of structured in BC and put it into New England, would it still cost $600 a day? And my view is no. There's a lot of differences that would account for it to be higher. Your insurance here is quite different than what we see in BC. I guess there's some evidence that the wage rates are a little bit higher as well. But also, the existing National Marine Fisheries Service program is a multi-service program that covers the most efficient elements of the fleet as well as the least efficient. So if you're looking at a sector program that's only looking at the bigger boats that make longer trips, you're going to be looking at the more efficient element of the fleet. So in summary, my view is that I don't think you'd be seeing a $1,200 a day observer program for the sector fleet. I think it would be somewhere quite a bit less than that. This next table just puts this all together in terms of all the options, because if you're working with option two, then it would include option one, and so on. So we come out with a cost range for option one, as I said earlier, about 0.5 to about just under $1 million. For option 2A, it's just under $1 million to about $1.5 million, and so on. I go to option 3C, the extreme, which is 9.5 to 12.3 million. And then working that through in terms of cost per pound and so on, you see under all the option 3 levels, the cost per pound is 16 cents per pound all the way up to about 32 cents a pound. And in terms of the percentage of the value of the fishery, option 3, the high end of option 3C is around 21% of the value of the fishery. The option 3A is sort of in the 11 to 14% range. Within the dockside monitoring options, it's down at a much more reasonable level, 1.5 to 3% of the value of the fishery. And then the baseline data collection option 1 is sort of around 1 or 0.8 to 1.5%. Excuse me. So that's kind of, I think, a sense of what these types of things cost. I think the next step to really understand costing is sort of a more detailed business planning process where we didn't go into a real detailed or any detail at all in terms of thinking about if you were going to set up a system, how would you do it, where would you place resources, what kind of resources do you need, and all of that. But just taking what we know in BC and scaling it to what we think would be applicable to a fishery of this size gives us these kind of numbers. So I just want to quickly cover some of the cost sensitivities to think about. Firstly, in this process with this project, everything's been kind of a moving target. So the number of boats, the actual amount of activity, and so on, you just simply have to pin some numbers to work with. But certainly in a planning stage, you really have to kind of get better at figuring out what's involved, what sort of landing and activity is going to occur in the fishery, how many boats, how many days, all of these sorts of things will really significantly drive the cost. Also, the coverage requirements, coverage levels, what percentage of the fishery you want to monitor. We didn't really get into that issue at all, other than just providing some ranges. And then a second element of that is just thinking about what component of the fleet that you can monitor with cameras versus observers. If you go back and study the tables, you'll see that 100% monitoring with camera monitoring is costs less than the 3A option, which is 50% with observers and 50% with cameras. So that technology being, a quarter of the cost is really kind of, it's compelling to look at and think about what kinds of ways that you can make it work. Other things that affect the cost, just thinking about the specifications of the program, the timelines, what sort of audit levels you want to have, what kind of data are going to be collected, what sort of analysis is going to be done. All these things drive cost. And then nextly, labor strategies. These are service programs, and for the most part, labor is a really significant element of it. Labor in an at-sea observer program is probably 90% of the cost. In an electronic monitoring program, it's about 60% of the cost. So all of the things that you do that organize how people resources are put to the program will really significantly affect the cost. Equipment strategies, whether people own equipment or rent equipment, makes a big difference. In the BC fishery, as an example, it's currently monitored with the sort of a blend of ownership and renting, and the per-day cost with that blend is about $35 a day, whereas if people if the entire group were to rent equipment, it would go about double that cost. If everyone were to purchase equipment, it would still go up from 35, because you have a lot of boats that just don't have enough activity to justify the use. So thinking about that's important. And then lastly, cost recovery. We've suggested, and perhaps unpopularly, that there should be some element of industry funding in these programs. And our perspective is that in monitoring programs, industry is the group that so significantly drives, can drive the cost implications of the program. If you're trying to put observers on a vessel and you're working with industry and they're trying to control their costs, they're going to work very closely with you to try and make sure that that person is there for only what they're needed and in the most efficient way. If somebody else is footing the bill, then a lot of those incentives aren't there. So I think that's, when I compare the BC and the New England programs, I think that's one element that's really, really significant, is the importance of industry being kind of connected to the budget and the running of the program and being mindful of the costs. Just to close off, really, this, we really hope that the work that we've done just helps stimulate and advance the discussion on sector-based management. We've provided a lot of ideas, and we're not foolish to think that because we come from BC and we have things that apparently work well there, that it's going to be a rubber stamp thing that just works everywhere else. We've just tried to insert some ideas into your process, and hopefully that will be of benefit and interest to you. Coming out of this, I think there's two sorts of types of things that need to occur as well. One is that to really understand monitoring costs, I think you need to kind of move forward in terms of developing detailed program specifications. So really trying to pin down specifically what sorts of things the program needs to do. And I think some of the ideas we provided and the costing information we provided, I think will maybe inform some of that discussion to figure out what elements, you know, you think you're able to include and what you're not able to. And then lastly, I think some discussion about just how the program would work, the service delivery model, who's overseeing the program, who's funding it, all these kinds of things that just kind of guide the development of it. As I said earlier, in BC, the standalone independent third-party service delivery really arose out of the fact that there was no infrastructure in place to support these programs. And I'm fully mindful in New England that within the National Marine Fisheries Service, there's a tremendous amount of infrastructure already doing a lot of the things that we've proposed in these reports. So even if sectors were to set up as standalone operations, there's still a lot of functions that NIMS would continue to do in the non-sector parts of the fishery. So figuring out how that would get organized and how the service delivery would be set up, I think, is an important next step. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for a very informative and complete report. Are there any questions from council members? Dave Gaethel, and then Jim.
Yeah, I actually have quite a few. How do these cameras work at night?
We end up with vessels that are fishing night fishing. We end up with lighting issues where they have to make arrangements to light the area they're working. In general, the cameras record imagery about as well as, you know, with the light that a fisherman needs to see what. I'm not saying this very well. I'm sorry. The fishermen need light to work on deck. The cameras can certainly record imagery under that light. The problems that we have with night lighting are not so much about the sufficiency of light, but it's more around how the lighting is set up in relation to where the cameras are operating. So you're trying to eliminate glare, or, for example, if somebody's working at the rail, the fishermen may want to be seeing what's at their hands, but not really that concerned about what's happening as the line's coming out of the water. So we're interested in putting the lighting in a different way, so we're seeing more of what we're interested in. So it's a resolvable solution.
Okay, because I mean, for a lot of our boats, a lot of the mobile gear boats, they just have 12 volt lights. We don't have generators or anything. Yeah, I got a couple lights there that a crewman can, like you said, they're focused on his hands to measure the flounders. That's about it. And there's not going to be any more light because there's no more power capability to put this stuff in. That was one question. The other was, what about winter? You know, I come in a lot of times, the whole boat's covered with ice, including wherever that camera is going to be. Is that an issue there, or do they only fish in the summer or something?
Well, I know that there are a lot of, you know, cold weather applications with cameras where they put heater elements in the housing and so on to deal with that. We haven't worked with that at all. We've done a lot of work in Alaska, I will say. And we haven't really had icing issues to deal with. So,
yeah, but I think in Alaska it's the same thing. Other than the really big boats that work in the Bering Sea, you know, or something, that most of the fisheries conducted in the summer, or at least in the spring when the weather's reasonable. So that's another consideration that I think we got to at least look at. The other thing I noticed is that you still need an observer at some point in this. You know, to to go over all this camera stuff, or probably a whole bunch of observers. It seems to me that we just shift the observer from the back deck, where you have a real person collecting information, to sitting in a cubicle somewhere trying to decipher all this film. Is that accurate?
There's two elements to this. One is that the audit-based modeling monitoring that I mentioned is that you might you choose to randomly sample the imagery. So a real good example might be in BC, a longline fishing trip, an average trip might be 12 days, and when you look at actually the hauling imagery, the recorded imagery for all the hauling events on that trip might be 25 hours of time. And if you're random sampling that to verify the accuracy of the logbook, then you're down to 3 or 4 hours. So, you know, your point about shifting, it's even more compelling than that, because you're taking a 10-day observer deployment on a longline trip down to maybe, 4 or 5 hours of analysis time that somebody's doing in the lab. The other thing about sort of shifting the labor is that moving from the field to an office setting, you can just manage these activities in a more scheduled way, so that it's easier to kind of deal with a workload with workload issues like that than in a field. So,
my last question was, what happens when part of the system fails for some reason? I guess I'm just don't have much faith in anything electronic. We've shown with the VMS system, we've had problems. I mean, I got all these electronics in my wheelhouse. A good deal of them right now are scattered somewhere between here and Japan in various states of disrepair. Do people have to tie up? I got a piece of electronics been missing for 2 months now. Do I have to tie up for 2 months because I can't get another camera or whatever? I got to buy another one? I just like to know a little bit more about, what your experience has been with when the system doesn't work.
Okay, I think a lot of the answers to your questions really relate to the governance structure of the program and how it's set up and what sort of rules are in place. But I can tell you from experience the programs that I work with. I mentioned in the presentation that fishermen are required to have the system operating all the time. If it's not operating, they have to come to port. We provide, through the user interface, we provide different tools so that we can help them troubleshoot problems and hopefully sort them out at sea. Over the course of the year, I think last year we had out of about 2,500 trips, we had about 17 trips where the equipment failed and the vessel had to come in. And when we looked at them, we felt about half of those were problems that could have been resolved at sea. So it ends up putting very high reliability, requirements on the program, and you're constantly running around trying to deal with that. In the crab fishery, which is another one I didn't mention, but it's a 50-vessel fleet, and there's industry strongly behind that program because of some of the gear theft issues. In a typical year, we generate about 55,000 hours of monitoring time, and in the last 3 or 4 years, the amount of downtime is less than 150 hours. So the performance rate is very high with this equipment, and it's not just the equipment, it's all of the kind of the rules and everything that you set up in place to make it work that way. Guys come in with a broken system, there's a spare one there that the program will provide so that they can turn around and go fishing right away.
Thank you. On pages 26 and 27 of the report, you have a comparison of the BC and the NIMS Northeast Observer Program, and I know that you've had some phone calls or emails with Amy Van Atten, who is currently running the Observer Program, and I think she identified some text or numbers in here that she didn't feel was quite accurately representing the center. So I just wanted to mention that, and I think wondering if there'll be a chance to edit this, if we provide some comments on to correct what we might consider to be inaccuracies.
Yes, thank you. The information that I put into this report was based on an interview that I had with Amy Van Atten a few weeks back, and a week in advance of this report going to press, I gave her, I provided an excerpt of this text for her to review, and that stimulated her to spend quite a bit of time gathering some more comprehensive information, which she's provided to me. So unfortunately, her comments from her detailed comments didn't come to me in time to be able to affect this report, although we are hoping to receive comments by the 20th of June, and all of those comments would be incorporated into the final version of the report. So I think the most significant sort of, in the very first paragraph of that text, I indicated that the 1,200 figure may not include salaries of other staff, and she indicated that it did. So to me, that's the number of 600 for the BC program and 1,200 for the New England program. Those are real numbers that you can actually look at and compare. So it does really beg the question, why are these two programs so different? Some of the information about the observer wage rates I don't think is accurate. And it gets into the difficulty of trying to compare these things because the whole method of compensation is different between the two regions. So I'll definitely be adjusting the text to reflect some of that thinking.
Yeah, thanks for an interesting presentation. I've got three questions. One is, who funds and administers centralized data processing in BC?
Are you referring to sort of like the option one baseline data collection, or just a more general sort of data processing?
More general as a part of your presentation. It just sort of, you were talking about industry participation and investment, and if we have a centralized data processing, just curious who is paying for it, and how the information is being administered and who it went to, et cetera.
Okay. Within the ATSI Observer Program and Electronic Monitoring Program, the Department of Fisheries funds about 25% of the total cost of the program. And I was looking around to try to find some really, really clear principles that were outlined that specify what they pay for and what they don't pay for. And there don't appear to be any that I could find. But in spirit, it really kind of comes down to their funding. The agency, Department of Fisheries, is funding the part of the program, that kind of the background part of the program, the administration, the data processing, the data delivery, the training of the observers, all of the sort of the functions that operate in the background. And industry funds the part of the program they see, so the observer on the dock or the camera on the boat, all of the things that they do in relation, that they more or less control. So now within dockside monitoring programs, that history doesn't exist. So industry typically pays for 100% of the program.
Okay, thanks. The second question is, when you ran the image of the longline vessel with the camera monitoring the length of the fish, was that scale electronically an electronic image, or was that painted on the side of the vessel?
I wish it was the former, but when you get into monitoring, putting cameras on fishing vessels, you really are stuck in a situation where you're working with their platform. We can't specify a whole lot, so we're opportunistically putting the cameras in the best place we can, and we're working with them the way they've got their boat set out. So if you wanted to move towards more technically based, image recognition, measurement of fish and so on, then you really are moving in a direction where the fish have to be channeled very, very specifically in a certain way. And I don't think that's probably not in the near future for a lot of these applications. So to answer your question, we provide a template for a measurement board. There's four different species that have size-based determinations that are made. The fish that come up are, the color coding is really to provide a very simple reference as to whether or not the fish is above or below the legal size standard. And all of those determinations are made by the viewer.
Okay, thank you. My last question refers to Table 6 on the cost estimates for the monitoring options. And it's in reference to the low and the high for both the cost per unit and the total cost. There's some pretty significant differences there, and I was just wondering if you could elaborate on the range of variables. It doubles the cost of the monitoring. And with some of the small boats that we have, they're going out there scraping out a day's pay. It'd be a significant cost burden.
Okay. Can you just point me to a line so that I'm not trying to guess?
We can start on the top line. You know, option one, baseline data collection. You have a low cost per unit of 25 and a high of 45. A low cost of low total cost of 380,000 versus a high cost of 684,000. I'm just wondering what the variables are between those two extremes.
Okay. Baseline data collection and dockside monitoring is really scaling on landings. So the unit cost there is a cost range per landing event. So 25 to 45 for option one, each of those numbers multiplied times 15,200 is going to create the range that's there. So it's and that sort of line of thinking flows all the way through. When you get to option three, they all scale on sea days rather than number of trips. So.
Jim, I don't know if there are other questions. We are going to try and wrap this up around 12:30, so.
Yeah, I notice in your at sea, in all your proposals, you have either 100% or 50%. And I know that in Nova Scotia, they're successfully monitoring an ITQ program on Georges Bank with 20% coverage. So, I mean, that would change the cost factor dramatically if we could have a system that was around 20%. Did you look into the Nova Scotia Maritime system?
No, I didn't. And you're absolutely right. And I point that out in the sensitivities, the coverage levels, because particularly with the at-sea observer or camera monitoring, so much of those costs are labor. If you reduce the coverage level by 10%, you're reducing the cost by, you know, probably eight to nine percent. So it really does translate quite well. I'll just tell you my views on coverage levels, and you guys can take it for what you like. But I see two different arguments here. One around coverage levels. You know, one is sort of the scientific statistical kind of sampling theory, where you've got an understanding of accuracy and data quality that you're trying to achieve, and you look at the variability in your sampling, and then decide what kind of coverage level you need to try to capture all of that variability. The other kind of element in coverage levels is really around what I call behavior modification. If you're monitoring a fishery to try to understand discards in the fishery, and you decide to put 30% coverage on the fleet, then I would argue that you're only really kind of controlling discarding on 30% of the fleet. There's 70% out there that nobody has any idea what's going on. And they may be very compliant, just like the monitored part, or they may not, but the main point is you have no idea. So our experience in BC is that all these fisheries have moved to 100% monitoring simply because the monitoring system's in place to create a level playing field and create a level of accountability in the fishery that would not otherwise be achieved with any other lower level of monitoring. So it's just really an issue of kind of I think Bruce pointed it out well in the phase one report. Was it really an issue of kind of defining your objectives and thinking about what you need to do that?
Any other questions? Sally.
Just a few comments. Thanks for this. I think that in light of the discussion, especially that we had yesterday on implementing the SBRM and the very clear lack of resources available from the government to do the kind of even minimal monitoring that the council has talked about wanting across all fisheries, that we need to be thinking about very different approaches because we can't squeeze blood from a stone. And we need to be looking elsewhere for ways to achieve the goals that everybody has acknowledged that we need. And you know, the cost is significant, but we have to consider what, you know, think, not forget about the discussion we had yesterday about the SBRM. And you know, there's risk in changing to a new system, but you know, I think we also need to think about the risk in sticking with the existing system, the existing days at sea system, in terms of risk, big picture risk to the industry. And lastly, as far as the potential failure of electronic monitoring systems, I don't know how many times we've talked about the failure of the actual observers who go out on boats too. So, you know, it's not just electronics that can fail. Actual human beings can as well. So, you know, there's equal opportunity for that. And you know, trying to look at it from the positive side, if we can actually have other options for collecting information on the fishery, then we should be considering those and not just sticking with the status quo, because certainly the status quo isn't working. So thank you for listening. Howard, thanks for coming. This was really helpful, and I hope this helps us take another step toward getting off the system that isn't working for us now. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else on the committee? Anybody in the audience have a question? We'll take two questions, the two right up front. Glenn first, or either one, you figure it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Glenn Levy, fisherman from Port Clyde, Maine, chairman, Mid-Coast Fishermen's Association. Just a comment and then a question. Whatever we do, I think it was touched on, the government doesn't have much money. We seem to be sending most of our profits now overseas in the form of oil prices, so there's not a lot of money in the fishing industry side of it either. I think there needs to be a goal here. It seems like this may give us an opportunity to see what's going on in specific areas. Maybe we could use it as a refinement tool to either change the way the gear works, to reduce discards, maybe identify areas where there's high discard rates and have spot closures or something like that. But eventually it would reduce the need for monitoring if we could refine the system that much, or change the way that people fish. Just counting dead fish that are being thrown overboard isn't really going to get us where we want to go. We should really try to use it as a tool to increase selectivity and change fishing behavior, leaving the small fish or what have you on the bottom where they can live. And I just, the question I had for this gentleman was, have you noticed a change in fishing behavior, or has there been any research done along these lines to try to reduce discard since this monitoring has been put in place?
Well, I guess I can think of, there's two types of changes that one's seen. In British Columbia, the groundfish fishery, it's an integrated fishery where I didn't really touch too much on it, but there's several different separately licensed groups. And historically, halibut fishermen who were licensed for halibut had very severe restrictions on other types of fish that they were allowed to catch under that license. So the integration allowed for halibut fishermen to purchase rockfish and sablefish and other things that they routinely encountered So it's actually created a market system for moving a quota around between the license holders, and halibut fishermen are very, very concerned about fishing practices of halibut in all the fisheries that they sell their quota to. And likewise, rock fishermen are as well. So there's this sort of consciousness about just the value of the quota and the really wanting to be certain that the catch figures for quota that they're selling is accurately reflected. So that's one big difference. And I would even go further to say that I would argue that in the future in British Columbia, the data quality requirements for the monitoring program are going to be driven more by the industry business of selling quota than it will be by science needs for understanding the accuracy of catch. The second thing, though, is I think also kind of equally important, but maybe a little bit more abstract, is that the idea of using audit-based monitoring, it made sense to us because it's just simply a way of saving money. You don't have to hire somebody to sit there and review 100% of the imagery when you ask the fishermen to record the data and you're using the cameras just to decide how good those data are. But that whole process, I think, has a huge positive spin-off in the sense that fishermen are actually paying more attention to catch, and they're troubled by the problems of when you're on a longline vessel and you've got one fish coming after another on hooks, how do you actually accurately account for that? What sort of counting methods do you use to keep accurate counts of things that are not only being kept but going back over the side? So I think that that involvement really creates kind of a sense of engagement for industry, and that, in my mind, I think just that filters all the way up. You know, suddenly they're the contributors of the data, and when they're sitting around in groups like this where people are talking about uses of data and so on, they have a much, much stronger connection to it than, you know, other methods where they're not involved at all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, folks. Howard, I believe, right? No. Okay, Howard. Do you think it'd be possible for you guys to design a system with a combination of electronic monitoring and VMS so that you'd be able to sell nymphs that we don't actually need bodies out at sea? We can use the cameras and the VMS to pinpoint locations at a particular time and then audit, you know, on shore to save a considerable amount of money?
Electronic monitoring, I guess it's different than observers in that electronic monitoring is always sort of designed around very, very specific, particular monitoring needs. So to kind of make a blanket statement about, you know, yeah, we can put cameras on all the boats and get rid of all the observers, I think is really, really erroneous in the sense that we rely on observers to do a lot of different things. We can get a lot of value out of the technology to give us information on fisheries, but in a lot of cases, we're not going to be getting as good a data as an observer can provide. So, I mean, I think that's important. You can go a long ways with the technology so long as you have the fishermen that are working with you. You know, if their fish handling practices and the kinds of ways they're doing things is amenable to being monitored by the technology, then you can go further. So I think you can probably save a lot of money by looking at monitoring options in fisheries that really would be conducive to the technology approach. The linkage with VMS, I think that's just something that's coming. We're already starting working on that in some of the fisheries where there is a requirement for the cameras to be operating all the time. We're working on sending out what we call health statements, where the health of the electronic monitoring system goes out as a VMS, as a component of the VMS message that says how long it's been operating, and we're interested in incorporating other things like fishing log information, summary information from the EM system and stuff like that. So there are, you know, there's some development there.
So it would be possible maybe then to do like Jimmy Odlin said, use a 20% observer coverage in conjunction with the cameras and the VMS so that nymphs would be happy that they know where the boat is fishing at a particular time. And, you know, combine the three of those things and hopefully you'd have a program.
these tools work really well together. I mean, it seems to me totally reasonable that you can put camera coverage out on a, you know, on a much bigger part of the fleet than you can afford to monitor with observers, and you can use observers in a more selective way to get the kinds of data that you can't get with EM. There's also platforms we do in Alaska where you have a camera and an observer together because the observer is spending more time in the factory and the camera is needed up on top to look for seabirds and things like that. So
there's just one other point I'd like to make here. On page 17, we list the total landings for the New England groundfish industry at $73 million. And Howard's calculation here, if we went to 100% observer coverage, we'd be somewhere between $8 and $10 million. That's observer and electronic on the smaller vessels. We still have to add dockside monitoring to those totals, I believe, right?
The numbers at the bottom of table six are inclusive of, sorry, go to the next, table seven. These numbers are inclusive of all of the components. So if you were to do 3C, it would have the dockside monitoring element.
Okay. So if we had 100% observer coverage and electronic monitoring on the vessels that would take electronic monitoring, plus the observer coverage, we'd have $12 million in cost on a $73 million fishery, which is probably like 16, 17% of the total revenues for the industry. If we're going to do that, I make a plea to the NGOs in the audience that they come up with the money, because the industry does not have that kind of money. So I can't think of a better place for the NGOs to put their money than in something like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Howard. Are you going to be around for a little while this afternoon? Or
yes.
Okay, so that if people in the audience or anybody has some more questions, I'm going to say feel free to corner Howard and ask him.
Yeah, I would say I'm actually going to be in Portland for a few days, and so if I'm not, if you can't find me, then perhaps phone the folks at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and they can track me down.
Okay, it's 20 minutes to 1. Let's break for lunch until 2 p.m. It's Tom Neese, and spent the last hour.